Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 16 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And we are excited to be here for another week of The Mental Breakdown podcast. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about today. On this Saturday morning, another Saturday morning. We worked on Saturday morning last week.
Saturday mornings, it's another work day. Just when we get to Friday, what is the phrase we use? Just
two more days.
Two more work days until Monday.
That's right. So just thinking about a few big things that's happened since the last podcast.
Yeah.
U.S. national team won the World Cup.
That's right.
They did a great job. What a final that was. Great job. You know, when you think about tying this into our topics, of course, when you think about the mental energy, the concentration, the motivation, the work that you have to put in to accomplish something like that, it's pretty tremendous. Today's the women's finals for Wimbledon. Serena Williams is playing against someone. I can't remember who she's playing against, but that's a big match today.
Right.
And so lots of sports stuff going on. Okay. The U.S. men's national team is in the middle of the Gold Cup. They've won both of their first games, and they've already made it to the next round with one game to spare. So everything is going well for the U.S. athletics-wise.
Right.
Like I said, we like to tie that into our psychological talk because, my goodness, again, when you think about the kind of work that takes and the dedication that it takes to perform at that level, it's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So today we are going to talk a little bit more about ADHD. I guess we've dedicated a number of podcasts to it, but it's a disorder that's prevalent enough that I think warrants the amount of attention that we're paying to it. We also received a few more emails that we want to go over because these are some really good emails that touch on some pretty important topics. We'll probably only get through a couple of them today because there's a lot for us to talk about. When we got these emails, we actually went in and did a little bit of research, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to make sure we had some good information for
right.
you.
Right. Good information. Good questions. Glad to hear from our listeners. And they're asking really good and appropriate and timely questions. So I'm looking forward to getting the discussion going on these. So welcome to all of you who are listening. And send us your questions. Keep sending us your questions.
Absolutely. And what I find is that a lot of the questions that we're being asked lead to us needing to go and find out more information.
Right.
Because, you know, when we practice day in and day out, and, you know, we know the things that we talk with our patients about, and what's fantastic is some of the questions that we're receiving are making us think
right.
about things a little bit more.
That's right. It educates us, and it makes us better, because you tend to say the same things over and over again, and then but your questions, listeners' questions, impel us to go back into the literature and update things and see where things came from. Learned a lot of new things this week in tracking down the answers to our listeners' questions. So we look forward to talking about them.
That's great. So let's just jump right into the first one. How's that sound?
Good, good, good.
All right, so this first one is from Jason. It says, "Dear Drs. Richard and Bernie, I'm a teacher in an elementary school studying students with special needs. I have listened to your podcast and would like to know more about why the increase in ADHD has exploded over the past few decades. I recently moved to Florida from California, and it seems that the number of kids with ADHD in Florida far outnumbers those in California. Can you shed any light on this?" Wow.
What is his name? Jason?
Jason.
Wow, Jason.
So that's, and it's great that you're making that observation, because clearly you're correct. And we went in, and as we were talking about earlier, we went out and we did a little bit of research in this and looked at some of the numbers. And Jason, your observation is exactly right. It's
correct.
Exactly consistent mm-hmm. with what we've been reading about. And that is that the number of diagnoses and the treatment of ADHD varies pretty dramatically. By region.
By geographic region in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we talked before in previous podcasts about sort of the history of ADHD. We've talked about how it's been around since at least the 1700s or 1800s, mm-hmm. as it relates to where it's been written about. And we have case studies and stuff that have been described from, you know, hundreds of years ago. And so we talked about that before, but Dr. Richard, you found some new information that that I think is very compelling to talk about why in the past few decades we have seen such a big increase in ADHD.
Right. Well, first of all, Jason, you're right. The rates in California do differ from the rates here in some southern states. But the issue of... I think the larger issue, I think, Dr. Burney, you're asking why we see this explosion of rates
right.
in the diagnosis.
Right.
Okay. And that's a frequently asked question. Is there really more ADHD today than there was years ago?
Right.
Right. And the answer to that is probably not.
Right.
The number of children and adults with this disorder probably hasn't really increased. What has increased is the number of people who are diagnosed with the disorder.
Right, and I think that we kind of went through that a little bit in episode 11 or 12, somewhere around there.
But I think to put some order to it, I think it's fairly safe to assume that nationwide, the prevalence rate is about 9.5%.
Right.
About 9.5% of school-age children.
Right.
End up with a diagnosis of ADHD, which
right.
is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
To answer Jason's question, the rate in that 9.5% is an average.
Right.
Okay. So just to show you how averages come about, the rate in California is 6%.
Right.
The rate in North Carolina is 15.5%.
Right.
So there's something about these regional differences that are affecting the number of children who are diagnosed, who are referred, and who end up with this diagnosis of ADHD. And I think that's the first point, is that yes, there are regional differences. And we're going to talk here about what happens in these regions that ends up resulting in a diagnosis of ADHD.
Right.
We need to talk about that.
Now, Richard, where did you grow up?
Pennsylvania.
I grew up in Florida.
Uh-huh.
All right. And my family were very southern, is a very southern family.
Right.
Families from Alabama and North Carolina. And a lot of my family, when we were growing up, it was what we would now consider more authoritarian types of parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are expected to behave a particular way. Because that's the way kids are supposed to behave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we talk about different parenting styles, like authoritative and authoritarian, and the differences between these are sometimes very drastic.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have these different expectations, we evaluate a child's behavior in very different ways. So
right.
I think that part of the explanation for these regional differences are the expectations that culturally
that's right.
we have of children.
Right.
Again, when I was growing up, now we heard this a lot, and I've already shared that I had ADHD and grew up with some of those challenges. I continue to have some of those challenges.
Well,
no comments.
We bring those challenges into adulthood with us.
Yes. I still want to...
I'd like to leave them behind. That cow is another story we'll talk about at the end. And that's COW, cow, we'll talk about
yeah.
later. It doesn't stand for anything except an animal. Yeah, we'd like to leave this behind. In fact, for a long time, we thought that ADHD somehow disappeared
right.
in adolescence.
Right.
Now we know that it doesn't. Kids with ADHD become adults with ADHD.
Right, right. So, you know, I grew up with some of these difficulties, and, you know, we were constantly told, you know, kids are to be seen, not heard.
Mm-hmm.
We were expected to behave a particular way, and if we couldn't, then we were often seen as problematic. We were seen as challenged. Now, of course, in the 80s, we weren't sent to the doctor as often,
right.
And medications weren't prescribed as frequently. I remember Dr. Jim, he was my pediatrician. He told my mom medication is a possibility,
mm-hmm.
But it was never pushed the way that it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But we were raised with the idea that, you know, everything is yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Everything was being quiet, sitting still.
Was the value.
That was the value.
And now it surprises us Northerners to come down here and hear people say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir.
Right.
And to have, I mean, that was a shock to us because it just wasn't expected of us. Growing up north, okay? So the expectation of how children act and talk is very, very different in the South.
Right.
And that expectation will drive the need
right.
to come up with this kind of a diagnosis.
Right.
Because if you think about that in schools, I mean, if children are expected to sit still in desks and be polite all day long, and they don't, then you have to look for some reason for that. If you don't have that expectation, then you don't look for the reason. You don't look for an explanation.
Right. And even as I've become, became a psychologist and began working in the field and looking at this and reading about different places around the country that manage these issues in different ways, I'm still taken aback when I hear about schools in the West and schools up in the Northeast where, you know, they have those desks that stand up so students can stand at the mm-hmm. at their seats instead of having to sit all day long. And mm-hmm. I was reading an article the other day about treadmill desks where students can walk on a treadmill while they're working mm-hmm. at their desk.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And they talk about how this improves a student's ability to right. focus and concentrate. Those kinds of things. Well, now you work here in the South. We don't do any of that stuff here. Mm-hmm. And probably many of our listeners who are probably also from the South, those sound like very strange things to them
right.
as well.
Right.
Because we have a very different view here in the South about what we expect from children.
Right.
And as you said, Dr. Richard, when we have those expectations and then those expectations aren't met, we need a reason why.
We look for an explanation, right.
Mm-hmm. And typically, that explanation is provided via a diagnosis. And we look for a treatment often via
mm-hmm.
medication.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the reasons, I think, that we see this significant increase in the number of, in the prevalency rate here in some regions
yeah.
Than we do in other regions.
Right, right. The expectation is very different here. And I'm sure the expectation was different in whatever community they grew up in California was different from whatever community they were growing up in North Carolina. But I think that
right.
that single case shows that the expectation in North Carolina was different than the standards and the expectations in California.
Right.
And I think we run into the same thing, and I guess we'll get into this about school expectations.
Right.
Because as school expectations change, behavioral expectations change.
Right.
So, but we'll be getting into that later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a good transition into that because what we see in some of the research that we did to try to answer Jason's question is we see that there were certain things done in mm-hmm. school legislation that contributed, at least in part, to this explosion in
right.
the number of diagnoses. And this
right.
this is some information that we've kind of put together even since the previous podcast that we did where we were talking about some of these issues
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, again, ADHD has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And when we've talked about, you know, even in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when Ritalin came about and we really started using that medication, the diagnosis even then did not significantly increase. And it wasn't until, the 1990s?
1990s.
When the explosion really took hold.
Right.
And Dr. Richard, tell us a little bit about what you found that happened in 1990 that probably contributed to some of this explosion.
Well, let's go back and remember. Now, Jason's question was about the explosion
right.
and diagnosis, right? And so the first thing, we talk about regional differences. But what we also need to remember is that these are differences in expectations. A few weeks ago, we mentioned the name Russ Barkley.
Right.
Okay, generally recognized as the expert on ADHD. He did a video a short time ago, and in the video, he stresses over and over again that that ADHD is a difference between what a child is expected to do at a certain age and what the child is doing
right.
at a certain age.
Right.
So that it's not... we expect a two-year-old to have temper tantrums. We don't expect an eight-year-old to have temper tantrums.
Right.
The problem is not the temper tantrum, it's the temper tantrum at a different age.
Right.
Okay.
And in fact, most mental health is like that.
Is like that.
There are times, mm-hmm. developmental times and situational times, where any mental illness that we can think of is appropriate.
Would be normal at
right.
a certain age.
Exactly.
It's abnormal at 15, but it's normal at 7.
It's normal for a 6-year-old to have an imaginary friend.
Right.
If a 15-year-old is talking about imaginary friend, we got to start worrying about other things.
We start to worry. So the abnormality is determined more by age
right.
than the behavior.
Right. right, developmental level.
And so that's the first thing we have to remember, is that with ADHD, we're talking about the difference between what is age-appropriate
right.
and what shouldn't be occurring anymore.
Right.
Okay. And so whether we're talking about an infant or a toddler or a preschooler, a kindergarten's kid, a school-aged child, or an adult, it's the expectation
right.
that's not being met.
Right.
So that's one issue, is expectation. And the second issue is that if the requirement of the environment is too demanding, you're going to get the kind of behaviors we see
right.
with ADHD.
Right.
I have a boy in right now who was going to he decided to go to an IB type of high school,
right.
a very high pressure college preparatory high school when he was a ninth grader. And he was a good student. There was no reason why he couldn't do the work. But it was a little bit too much for him to do. And so the first question came up was, well, does he have ADHD? He became very anxious and inattentive and had trouble doing homework, all the things we typically associate with ADHD. What we learned very quickly was it wasn't that he had a disorder. It was the curriculum was a little bit more than he was able to do.
Right, right.
But that curriculum elicited or resulted in the symptoms that we associate with ADHD.
Right.
You can do the same thing with a toddler, with a 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, well, this 2-year-old should be doing A, B, and C. But if the 2-year-old can't do that,
right.
then we're going to look for, well, is there something wrong with my 2-year-old?
Right.
No, there's something wrong with your expectation.
Right.
Didn't you tell me something that you read some article this week about putting 1-year-old children on medication?
Yes, there was a wonderful article that came out. I say wonderful just because it was informative,
alarming.
And alarming. And I put it up on our blog and website. And that is that they were talking about the significant increase in in prescriptions for antipsychotic medications in children and adolescents, and surprisingly. The primary diagnosis being that this medication was being prescribed for was ADHD. Now, we both know that that is almost counterintuitive from a neurobiological chemical perspective, because mm-hmm. what we know about ADHD is you need an increase in dopamine and
right.
norepinephrine, and antipsychotic medications decrease.
Just the opposite.
So it was bizarre, and what the article was talking about was that the antipsychotics were being prescribed for the agitation and irritability that you sometimes see with mm-hmm. ADHD. Mm-hmm.
In young children.
And that was the most alarming piece, is that the sample that they were talking about were children from the age of 1 mm-hmm. to 18. So that what that suggests is that there is a subgroup of kids that are 1 year old that have been not only diagnosed with ADHD, but are being treated with antipsychotic medications for ADHD.
Okay.
Talking about alarming, that
right.
is,
right.
That blows my mind.
That's a classic example of inappropriate expectations.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can't make that diagnosis in a 1 year old.
Right.
Period. Okay.
Right.
Well, so when we talk about expectations, here's another example of a school, of where expectations become important. There was a study done not long ago of kindergarten kids,
mm-hmm.
and it was discovered that young kindergarten kids, those with early birthdays,
right.
summer birthdays, have rates of ADHD that are 60% higher than the children with later birthdays.
Right.
So even within a grade,
right.
the early birthdays tend to have much higher rates of ADHD. Well, again, it's probably not ADHD. It's that a child who's almost 6 can handle the curriculum of a kindergarten class, where a child who's just turned 5 has right. a much more difficult time.
And I think that part of what we, maybe another podcast that we should do, maybe next week, is talking about the issue of socialization
yeah.
and how socialization comes about as a part of a developmental process.
Mm-hmm.
And a 3.5-year-old is socialized very different than a 4-year-old.
Right.
During those first 5 or 6 years of life,
mm-hmm.
6 months makes a tremendous difference
right.
in expectations and development. And So absolutely, it's not surprising that, you know, the study would find that a kid whose birthday is in August differs and has a much higher risk of being diagnosed with ADHD when they're in the same class with somebody whose birthday is in May.
Almost a year older.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. So that's one issue. And I think that this date of birth, maturity, especially in young children, because mm-hmm. when you're 4 years old, a 9-month difference is 20% of your life.
Right.
You know, it's not when you're 40.
Right.
You know, 9 months doesn't matter. You can even marry somebody 9 months younger. But because the difference doesn't mean anything. But when you're 5 years old, a difference of 9 or 10 months is a significant part of one's life.
Right.
And a significant number of experiences. So one thing to remember, one thing we have to keep in mind when we talk about why are we seeing so much more of it, is we have to think about expectations.
Right.
You know, are the expectations appropriate? But there's a second reason, and if you're taking notes, I'm sure you're taking notes, I would make this Roman numeral 2, because this is a change of topic. The other reason why we're seeing an explosion of ADHD is that ADHD over the last 60 years, 50 to 60 years, has become more and more a part of the medical and educational community.
Right, right.
And by that I mean that this disorder was really first, it's been around for a long time, but as a medical disorder, was first described in the late 1940s.
Right.
Right. And since then, since 1947, we've seen a gradual popularizing,
right,
I think that's the right word, of this disorder. So that we have the first description in the 1940s. By 1957, they have a disorder called minimal brain dysfunction.
Right.
Okay. And by 1960 and 1968, we see the name changing to something called the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood. So by 1968, we finally have a name for this disorder.
Right.
We've seen it in kids since the 1700s. We sort of named it in 1968. Now, listen carefully. In 1975, the United States federal government began to assist states in educating children with developmental educational challenges. Okay. It was called the Education of All Handicapped Children Act. But ADHD wasn't part of that.
Right.
Okay. Learning disabilities was, mental impairment was, physical impairments were, hearing impairments, vision impairments. Okay. Yeah. But ADHD was not part of that in 1975.
And they pretty much made a decision not to include it.
That's right. That's right. They weren't sure what to do about it. It hadn't been clearly defined. We, as the medical community, really wasn't treating it yet.
Right.
There was very little treatment for the disorder. It was not very well defined yet.
Right.
You know? And so it was not part of this first educational act.
Right.
Okay. However, by 1980, we do have a diagnosis.
The psychiatric, what do we recognize now?
Right. Psychiatric community said, yes, this thing really does exist. It was called attention deficit disorder with and without hyperactivity. Later, it became known as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So the name changes and the definitions change and the symptoms get clarified. So by the end of the 1980s, there is this disorder. And then in 1990, the Educational Act is reauthorized
right.
as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. In that act in 1990, ADHD is recognized
right.
as a disorder, as an educational disorder.
Under other health impaired.
It's considered a medical diagnosis.
Right.
So it comes under the category of other health impaired. So the important date here is 1990. ADHD is recognized as a disorder that could affect a child's education in 1990.
And more importantly, or as importantly, is that because it's recognized like that, that means funding for the school.
Changes everything.
It changes everything because right. now it's recognized as something that's going to impact a child's ability to learn
right.
so that the child can receive special education services,
that's
which
right.
will then bring additional funding to that school as right. a result of a handicapped student.
That's right. So it was also at this time that ADHD, you can get SSI funds if you're low income
right.
for having ADHD. So
right.
in 1990, for the first time, we recognize ADHD as a disorder. That's why it's starting to increase.
Right.
And because prior to that, we didn't recognize it.
Right.
1990, we begin to recognize it. In the late 1990s, so we recognized the disorder in 1990. By the late 1990s, prescriptions for stimulant medication have increased threefold. They've tripled by the end of the 1990s.
In less than 10 years.
In less than 10 years. That's when we saw this big explosion.
Right.
It was because it was first recognized, first of all, in the educational community, and then second, parents were very interested in pursuing the diagnosis. You know, could this be my child's problem?
Right.
And apparently many of them did get treatment because the number of prescriptions increased by threefold
right.
in less than 10 years. Okay. In 2000... the first long-acting medication was prescribed. For
right.
for a lot of families who had to use the medications, they had to give the medication in the morning and then they had to give a noon dose at school.
Right.
And that was embarrassing. So that was also a detriment. That also got in the way of some
right.
parents said, well, I don't want my child to be singled out. I don't want people to know he's taking medication. But as soon as the pharmaceutical companies came up with a medication that a child could take just once a day in the privacy of his or her home,
right.
medication really became popular. So again, we see a significant increase in medication from 1900 to 2000 because the disorder is recognized. And then again from 2000 because we have a medication you can give once a day.
Right.
So once again, we see a spike
right.
in the use of medication for this disorder. So the reason that you see this explosion, there's two reasons, but the main reason is that once the disorder is recognized
right.
and children can get accommodations for high-stakes testing and all, and SAT testing and college accommodations, then once parents find out about that, once schools realize that accommodations are available, then you have an increase in the rates of the diagnosis. So is the diagnosis increasing? Probably not. But the diagnosis is increasing. The real incidence of the disorder is not increasing. It's that we're just recognizing it now. But there are very good explanations, very reasonable explanations for why the rates are increasing.
Right. There were probably just as many kids back then.
Absolutely.
With ADHD as there are now.
There were as many kids in 1980 as there were in 2000.
Right.
The difference is it wasn't recognized in 1980 and it was in 2000.
And something has to be said as well about the acceptance of the idea of having ADHD.
Right.
You know, now there's no... I've never met a parent who is hesitant to say, oh, my kid has ADHD.
No, there's no stigma.
There's no stigma associated with it. It's
right.
just like, okay, you know, mm-hmm. 1 in 10 kids have it.
Right.
So, you know, hey, it's not
right.
that big of a deal. The same kind of thing is starting to happen, fortunately or unfortunately, with autism.
Right.
What is the prevalency rate? The last one I saw was 1 in 66, I think, boys.
Right.
1 in 88 overall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tremendous increase in the number of diagnoses, and
right.
it's just becoming more and more... I don't like the word accepted, but it's more and more okay for us to say, okay, this is what's going on with my child. This is why he's presenting this way. This is why he's behaving this way.
And I don't mean to be cynical about this, but you know, when we talk about expectations, the other thing that we have to remember is that if we go back to the year 2000, not only did we have the appearance of long-acting medications and a public law that recognized ADHD, we also had the beginning of two things. One was high-stakes testing in K through 12, and we also had high school exit exams.
Mm-hmm.
And when those two things were put into place, that raised the expectation bar again.
Right.
And so any child who couldn't make that standard, any child who couldn't pass the state test or pass the exit exam, in the states that had those exams, the rates of ADHD increased.
Right.
And by 2003, with No Child Left Behind, now we have a federal policy where every state has to do that.
Right.
So again, we see in the early 2000s, we see another bump. We see another spike, an increase in ADHD because for students who can't pass the exit exam at high school or pass the high stakes testing for that state, ADHD could be one of the explanations.
Mm-hmm.
Parents use it to get accommodations for their children.
Right.
Schools use it because in some states you don't have to count kids with ADHD in your school count.
Right,
in your testing data. So there's incentives
mm-hmm.
built into school systems for making this diagnosis.
Yeah.
And that was the second one that happened in the early 2000s.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, as you were saying that, and I was kind of thinking back again about the idea of how accepted, how the stigma is gone. You know, I was thinking at the, you know, when we think about media, and TV shows, it's not uncommon for people with ADHD to be depicted on TV shows. But you know, if you've read the a very popular series of books, young adult, not even young adult, they're considered children's books, the Percy Jackson series.
Mm-hmm.
I try to remember it. I think it's page 88 of the Lightning Thief, which is the first book in the series. Is when Percy Jackson talks about how he has ADHD and dyslexia and finds out that actually all the demigods have ADHD and dyslexia because it makes their brain work better as it relates to battling the monsters and stuff like that they need to battle as their role as a demigod. The dyslexia helps them read Greek. It's fascinating how this has just become a part of popular culture that, you know, someone who's seen as a hero, one of the reasons why he's a hero is because he has ADHD and, again, sort of increasing the acceptance of such a diagnosis.
Well, I have a question then.
Mm-hmm.
You are a you're knowledgeable about TV and other
yes.
frivolous activities. 1994, Matt Groening,
Groening,
creator of the Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
Listed among his official terms to avoid for 1994 was ADHD.
Yeah.
So it reached saturation. The
right.
ADHD reached saturation in the popular culture back in 1994.
Right.
Right. And it was during, what does that mean, The Simpsons? What, terms to avoid.
You don't know The Simpsons?
I know there's TV. I know, don't start. I know there's a show called The Simpsons. It's a cartoon.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What are terms to avoid for 1994? Was that part of the show?
Yeah, I think that was, I haven't heard about that particular story, but I think that there were things that he builds into his shows as far as part of the comedy and part of the, you know, one of the things that he does brilliantly, he does as well as Seth, I can't remember his last name, but that does the Family Guy. Some of the things that they do brilliantly is that they incorporate social issues and social concerns into their shows in a comedic and sometimes ridiculous way.
Right.
And I think that that's probably what he was talking about is, I mean, it's clear early on, you know, they were depicting Bart Simpson as a student with ADHD.
And that was in the 1990s.
Right.
And remember we said IDEA was 1990.
Right.
And that's when we saw this explosion of the diagnosis was after IDEA was authorized in 1990.
Right.
So it had reached some type of saturation
right.
by the middle 90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was like, okay, this is enough.
Okay.
We don't have to
okay.
keep pushing.
So
this.
It really was becoming popular in mm-hmm. that sense mm-hmm. by the 1990s. Okay.
Right.
And it has increased in the 2000s because of No Child Left Behind
right.
and because of the new medications.
Right.
So with those, we have an explosion in the number of children receiving the diagnosis. We
right.
don't have an explosion in the incidence.
Right.
We have an explosion in the diagnosis.
Right.
Okay.
And you know, again, kind of putting a bow on it is that, you know, again, when we talk about it in this way, what we're talking about is a mismatch between the expectations on the child
right.
and what the child is able to perform.
Right.
And as
mm-hmm.
we continue to expect more,
mm-hmm.
the diagnosis rate, whether the prevalency itself
right. Right.
changes,
mm-hmm.
the diagnosis of it is going to increase.
So in other words, if we took what we expect... A couple of weeks ago, we said the curriculum has been pushed down.
Right.
What we did in first grade, they now do in kindergarten.
Right.
If we pushed it down another year,
right.
now we expect preschoolers to do what kindergarten students do. That expectation would result in...
Even more ADHD.
More
right.
symptoms of ADHD
right.
because it's a mismatch between what's expected and what's
right.
age appropriate.
I do this with my my graduate students all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bring in a section from a book on molecular genetics.
Right.
And I will start doing a presentation
mm-hmm.
on molecular genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And
they start losing interest.
They start losing interest and
right.
they're fidgeting around and they're looking off at
mm-hmm.
nothing, signs that teachers usually refer to as ADHD. They're not ADHD. It's just that the material that I'm presenting to them is beyond their scope.
Beyond their ability. Right.
So we can definitely...
And we talked
that.
About that in our last podcast about athletes and students
right.
who, when they get to that next level, the expectation exceeds their performance
right.
and the symptoms can also appear then.
Absolutely.
It's a matter of expectations more than...
Right.
Okay.
Right, right.
Well, Jason, I hope that helped. That's a long explanation, but that was an excellent question, an excellent point that you bring up.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was good.
All right, we got one more email that we want to try to get to in the next 20 minutes.
Yeah.
We'll make this one quick for Cindy. She writes, "Dear Doctors Bernie and Richard, my son has ADHD. He's on 27 milligrams of Concerta, which is not an uncommon dose, but we choose not to give it to him over the summer." And that, too, is not a very uncommon thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
While we understand his ADHD symptoms, he seems to have such a difficult time making decisions and getting things done. A quick example is when we ask him to clean his room, which is always a mess. He will walk into his room without complaint and come out 5 minutes later saying that he's done. Of course, it looks like he hasn't done anything. Is this ADHD, or is it just him being lazy, or is he being disobedient? Thanks for your thoughts, Cindy.
Mm. How old is this boy?
She did not say.
He's taking 27 milligrams.
27 milligrams of Concerta.
Probably a young kid, right? That's right. Usually a starting dose. So we're going to assume that he's probably elementary school age.
I would guess so. Okay. Right.
Okay.
So, Cindy, that is not an uncommon problem at all, mm-hmm. Because we see these kinds of issues a lot in people with ADHD, but also other people as well. And in fact, a lot of the adults that I work with have similar types of issues. And what we kind of call this is we call these problems of getting started. In some of the tests that we use, they call it the initiate. How long does it take them once they have a task presented? How long does it take you to get started and get to work on it? Mm-hmm. I think it's great that Cindy recognized it as being at least related to decision making,
right?
Because it most certainly is. And then, of course, the getting started part, the getting initiated, and I think that there's several things that we need to talk about that's related to this. And the three things that we have to talk about with this is organization, mm-hmm. Getting started, and motivation. Okay? So those are our three things that we have to think about as it relates to these types of problems. And unfortunately, all three of these things are challenges for people with ADHD. So let's take, and all three of them are executive functions.
Yeah, that's, I'm thinking as you're talking that what we're talking about here are, when you talk about the ability to clean a room,
right?
You're really talking about a person's executive functions.
Right.
Have we talked about those before? Have we?
Not in a lot of detail, no.
Because if I may, one of the things that maybe that ought to be a podcast that we do, some things on executive functions, because ADHD is a disorder of the frontal lobes.
Right.
What we mean by that is that there is a brain chemical called dopamine, and there isn't enough of it in the frontal lobes. Okay, right. So people with ADHD don't push enough dopamine to the frontal lobes, and their frontal lobes remain underactive. Well, what does it mean to have underactive frontal lobes? What do they do? Well, the frontal lobes are in control of organization,
mm-hmm.
anticipation, inhibition,
self-regulation,
anticipation of consequences, the ability to self-regulate, the but also intrinsic motivation,
drive,
short-term
right.
memory.
Mm-hmm.
We frequently have parents will tell us, "Well, I tell him to go up to his room to get two items, and he comes back down with only one or neither one of them."
Right.
That's a short-term memory problem.
Right.
And it's a short-term memory problem because short-term memory is a frontal lobe phenomenon. It's a frontal lobe issue.
And let's throw this out there that our frontal lobe is really what separates the human animal from most other animals, including
right.
our primate relatives.
It's what makes us most human
right.
is our frontal lobe.
Because that is what helps tie all of this decision, all these things together. And that's why we call it the executive function, because
right.
it's sort of like your executive assistant.
That's your executive
keeps you
assistant.
Organized. It keeps you all put together so that you're making good decisions and behaving appropriately. And
so when she asks him to go clean his room, she's asking him to bring all these executive functions
right.
up there and make them all work and do something successful, do something successfully with them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So Cindy is
Cindy.
Her name?
Mm-hmm.
Cindy, write down executive functions because that's what we're going to be talking about.
Right. So let's start with organization because that's probably part, at least one of the first things that we try to address in treatment for kids with these types of problems. And we hear these things from parents all the time. And, of course, one of the things we hear is when we start talking about organization, the parents will say, well, the room is organized. There's a shelf that all the Legos are supposed to go on. There's a shelf that the Transformers are supposed to go on. There's a shelf where the cars go. All of that is great because that's a great start. The issue is that when we're asking the kid to go in there and utilize that organizational system independently, they begin to miss the pieces of those are the cars over there, this is where the cars go over here, and then implementing it right. to put it over there. How many times, Cindy, I would bet you hear this many times, when you go in there, you will ask them, you know, what are you doing? Why don't you put these things away? And they'll say, I don't know where it goes. And then you say, well, what goes there? And the cars go there. Well, where are your cars? They're right there. So where do those cars go? Oh, they go on that shelf. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start helping him put those pieces together, then it makes sense. But for some reason, because of that immature frontal lobe, children with ADHD oftentimes have difficulty doing that on their own.
Right.
They're not being oppositional, and you know, of course, we don't know your son, but that is typically not oppositional behavior.
I would guess it's not oppositional behavior. He's not being defiant. It's a frontal lobe issue,
right? Mm-hmm. And especially when you say that he goes up and he starts to work on it without complaint. Okay, right. He's not
defying you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he thinks, you know. He probably went in there and put a couple pairs of socks away and said, "Well, okay, that was done." And in his mind, and we hear this from kids all the time, my room, my mom says it's a mess, but I know where everything is.
Right.
In his mind, his room is organized.
It's organized, right.
Now, in a completely chaotic world, that's organization. Mm-hmm. But to them, that makes sense because
right.
all of these are things here that are red. Okay, it could include red shirts, red Legos, and red cars, but it makes sense that all of those go together in his mind for some reason. And so when it comes to organization, we really have to work to support the kid to help them understand a better organizational system, an organizational system that keeps everything more in place and structured in his world.
And this is why parents use labels.
Absolutely.
Or picture labels. You know,
right.
here's a picture of a car. So right. every time you see a car, put it over here.
Exactly. Okay?
And that's why parents label and picture things. Frequently, there are kids who need that extra
right.
cue or that extra prompt in order to be able to do it.
Well, and if you go into a kindergarten classroom,
that's why
everything is labeled.
Everything's labeled.
Everything
not just
labeled.
To learn vocabulary. It's also to help them stay organized.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So that's the first part problem. The second problem is the getting started part. Mm. And the getting started part this is a big problem. And this is a big problem for adults as well.
Right.
Because there are many, many, many times in our life that we are presented with a situation or a problem, and we sit there and we look at it, mm-hmm. and we think, how am I ever going to accomplish this task?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know where to start.
Right.
Part of that is organization, but part of that is just taking the mounds of information in front of you
right.
and being able to compile that into this is how I'm going to get started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I listened to a great podcast the other day where they were talking about these types of issues. And what they were saying is that, and it's great advice, even though it wasn't a mental health, it wasn't a psychology, it was more business related. But they were talking about you have to start with small pieces.
Right.
You can't walk in and look at this room that's chaos mm-hmm. and say, oh, you know, I'm just going to get started.
Mm-hmm.
Because, especially people with ADHD, that's a really difficult thing to do because they can't see the trees because of the forest.
Mm-hmm.
All they can see is this mound of clothes and toys and stuff all over the place. And they see that and they think, I don't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so as a parent, one of the things that you can do is, you know, again, we're not asking you to do it for him, but you stand at the door and you say, okay, here's what we'll do. Let's just clean this part of the room first.
Mm-hmm.
See the your bed. Okay, let's just start with your bed. Make your bed and put everything on your bed away.
Right.
Okay, don't do anything else. When you finish with that, come
mm-hmm.
and see me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you go back, you see that he's finished that. Then you say, okay, now we're going to clean under your bed.
Right.
All right, and so he gets that done. And you just work through quadrants, through the room,
mm-hmm.
and you have him do it one piece at a time. He's not being oppositional.
Right.
He wants to comply. And now you just need to provide the structure for him so that he knows how to get started, that little push.
Mm-hmm. And what you're doing as his mother is you are being his frontal lobes.
Right.
What you're acknowledging is my child has ADHD. His frontal lobes aren't working exactly the way they should.
Right.
They will eventually, but right now they're not. So I'm going to provide the frontal lobes.
Right.
You know, you do this in all other areas of your child's life.
Right.
So do it in this area too. All you're doing is you are providing those executive functions
right.
that he doesn't yet possess.
Right.
You know, he can't drive a car either, so mm-hmm. you drive the car for him. That's not being indulgent. That's not spoiling him. You're doing something that he doesn't, you're providing a skill that he doesn't yet possess.
Right.
Same with executive functions. You're simply providing your child with something that he doesn't yet possess. He'll get there, just like he'll get to drive someday.
And we use this kind of recommendation in education all the time.
Absolutely.
You know, when you put a sheet, and I love watching kids when you put them in this situation, you put a math worksheet in front of them that has
right.
50 questions on it.
Right.
They just sit there and look at it, and they're
yeah.
and you say, this is a time task.
Right.
Hurry up and get started. Mm-hmm. The amount of information there is just overwhelming to them because
right.
they start scanning the whole thing. When you talk to them about what you're doing, they're thinking, they say things like, well, I'm looking to make sure I know how to do all of them.
Right.
Well, it doesn't matter. You need to get started because remember, I just told you that this was a time task.
Right.
So one of the recommendations we use in that kind of situation is you get a blank piece of paper
mm-hmm.
and you only show them one row at a time.
Right.
And the speed at which they get started and accomplish a task
mm-hmm.
is incredibly faster
right.
just because, and all you did was you took away some of the extra stimuli. You structured the environment for him
right.
so that he could get started and not be so distracted with all the extra information.
Right.
Working on his room is the same thing, cleaning the garage. You know, we as adults, when we need to clean the garage, Richard needs to clean his garage. You start out one section at a time. You say, okay, I'm going to work on this
mm-hmm.
Set of shelves here, and then I'm going to work on this part, and I'm going to work on that part.
One area or one item or one something.
Right. Mm-hmm. I do that when I'm working with my wife and we're washing clothes and
right.
doing laundry and stuff like that. Okay, let's just get the whites done now. Because that's what we need right now.
Right.
And if you walk in there and there's these mounds of clothes, you think, oh my gosh, I don't even know where to get started. This is going to take forever.
Right.
So we have to break these tasks up into pieces. And it makes it much more manageable, much more realistic. And the task is going to get done.
Right.
So we have the organization piece. We have some strategies for getting started.
Mm-hmm.
And the last piece if we could figure out how to bottle this, it would be $1 million, $1 billion idea probably.
Idea. Mm-hmm.
And that is motivation. We are often asked, how do you increase motivation? And our answer always is, I have no idea.
You don't increase motivation. We really don't know how.
Right.
I have talked to psychologists who specialize in motivation. There are five or six people in the country. I've talked to two of them, and we really don't know enough about motivation to know how to really increase it.
Right.
We think we do. You know, we can offer kids bribes and rewards and incentives
right.
and all that, but that's not increasing intrinsic motivation.
And that's a great point. There's two types of motivation.
Mm-hmm.
There's intrinsic motivation, and that's the motivation from inside. That drives you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's extrinsic motivation, and that's where you're doing something for something external.
Right.
For many people, especially people who don't like their jobs, your paycheck is an external motivation.
Right.
If you weren't getting that, you probably wouldn't go to work.
I don't think you'd probably drive to work if you
right.
didn't get paid for it.
Right. Now, so external motivation are the rewards, the compensation. Work is getting paid for work isn't a reward. It's a compensation.
It's an exchange, right.
Mm-hmm. But it is an external motivation. Other things are intrinsic motivators.
Mm-hmm.
And that's things that we do because it makes us feel good. It makes us happy. When you are, when you start working out and you start, trying to get into better fitness, as you see changes in yourself mm-hmm. that increases your intrinsic motivation because you see those changes and you think, I want more of that.
Right.
It's not because anybody's giving you anything, and you may not even be getting any extra attention because of right. the work that you're doing or anything like that, but it makes you feel better and it makes you want to work more. And so it right. increases intrinsic motivation. Our issue is that we can provide all the extrinsic motivation that we can, mm-hmm. and it may or may not work. Richard and I have both worked with a lot of children where, you know, you say things like, I mean, sometimes parents go to ridiculous lengths to say, well, if you do your homework, we'll go get ice cream, or we'll go to Disney, or we'll do this if you just get your homework done. And the kid says no. Now, the kid loves to go to Disney. Exactly. They say, you know,
it's just not worth it.
It's just not worth it. That extrinsic motivation, as big as we may think that extrinsic motivator is, to the kid, is just not worth it. Or they still just don't have the capacity to overcome the absence of intrinsic motivation to get that done. So extrinsic motivation is great in some situations, but it has limited viability. It just doesn't work for everybody. And, right. and what's really frustrating for parents is it just doesn't work consistently.
And also, if you ask any parent, you know, what do you want of your children? You want intrinsic motivation.
Right.
No parent has ever said, I want my child to do things because she gets rewarded.
Right.
I want her to do things that she's interested in and that she's passionate about and that she wants to do for all the right reasons.
Right.
What we want is intrinsic motivation.
Absolutely.
So we don't want our kids to be motivated just for rewards
right.
or trinkets or
right.
trophies. We want them to do things that they're passionate about
right.
for whatever reason.
And you know, and the idea of using extrinsic motivators is a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had patients that we've worked with who it started out where the kid really didn't want to go to school. And so what the parent began to do was every morning on the way to school, they would stop by the store and pick up a little trinket or a
pack of gum or
something,
candy or something.
And what happened is the kid quickly learns that and begins to use that in a way to say, well, I don't want a 25-cent pack of gum. I want this dollar candy bar. Mm-hmm. And then it went from I want this dollar candy bar to I want this toy, or let's go to Walmart so I can get this toy.
That actually happened. We actually had a kid who did that. And he was getting a little toy, not a little toy.
Right.
$5, $6, $7 item every morning to go to school.
Every morning. And so the parent, you know, doing what they thought was the right thing, they continued to go down that route because
right.
it got the kid to school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this ended up blowing up, obviously.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
got to the point where there was really nothing that the parent could buy that would motivate the kid to go to school. So unless mm-hmm. he wanted a new video game or a new something that had just come out, there was no extrinsic motivator that could contribute to the kid complying and going to school.
Right. So the extrinsic motivator eventually stopped working.
It just wears out.
You couldn't satisfy it every day.
Right. And I always worry about that when people say, well, you know, if I work out, you know, I'll reward myself with a smoothie or a milkshake or something mm-hmm. like that. You know, what if you don't want a milkshake that day?
Right.
Well, if you don't want a milkshake, now what's your motivation to go running or to exercise or to get some tasks done? And what we find is that there is no motivator then, and then those things don't get done.
Right.
And so we really need to figure out, and you know, they're doing research to try to figure it out, but we really need to figure out a way to increase intrinsic motivation, because that's what's really going to elicit change and long-lasting change.
Mm-hmm.
Let me
throw something in here, too, and I apologize for interrupting.
Oh, no.
But you said at the beginning of this podcast that we learn things
mm-hmm.
in preparing for these podcasts and in preparing responses to our readers' questions.
Right.
And this is a case where I have to say I learned something, because there was a study done recently that said, in addition to, I think the study was from Yale University, that said, in addition to poor attention span and a lack of inhibition, Another thing that children with ADHD lack, probably children and adults mm-hmm. with ADHD lack, is intrinsic motivation.
Right.
And quite frankly, folks, I had forgotten all about that.
Yeah.
Because it's not something we typically talk about. But children with ADHD lack intrinsic motivation. So when we talk about what do we do with kids with ADHD, one of the things we have to remember is that they're not bringing a large amount of intrinsic motivation to anything they do.
Right.
If they don't seem to be interested in anything, they might not be.
Right.
Because that's one of the things that they don't possess in large quantities.
Right. And we see this with students all the time. You know, parents bring their kids in and they say, you know, he's such a smart kid. He could be making straight A's.
Exactly.
But for some reason, he's fine with C's.
Right. And it's not because he's lazy.
It's not.
We tend to attribute that to laziness. It's not late. It's a lack of intrinsic motivation.
Right.
And there are things that we can do about that. But I have a quick question. Are we nearing the end of this podcast?
We're getting close, yeah.
So can we put this talk about intrinsic motivation on another podcast?
Yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we dedicate the next podcast to the issue of motivation,
because it really is important.
Right, and we need to spend a lot more time on it. And that's, I was worried when I saw that we only had 20 minutes left for this question.
Right.
So yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we focus up the next podcast just on motivation? If you are listening to this and you have any questions or you mm-hmm. have any ideas or experiences with issues related to motivation, send us an email. Let us know. Because we want to, again, as always, make sure that we are giving you the information that you need and that you want that's going to help you in your day-to-day
right.
life. And motivation is certainly something that's going to be important, not just for our kids, but for mm-hmm. us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all need the motivation. We need the motivation sometimes to get up and go to work in the morning, or we need the motivation to, you know, cook dinner instead of going by the fast food place, or mm-hmm. So yeah, why don't we do that?
Motivation's an important issue, and as you said, Dr. Burney, you said that it's something we know very little about. We're not very good with extrinsic motivation. So what choices do we have? What can we do with our children, whether they have ADHD or not, who seem to lack intrinsic motivation?
Right.
It's an important topic, and I look forward to talking about that.
Yeah, so let's focus on that next time.
Okay.
All right. So, well, thank you for listening. Make sure that you jump on iTunes, and we would love it if you would write a rating for us or just write a little comment in there. It increases the number of people that see the podcast and can have the opportunity to find out that we're out here. If you have any questions, if you have any topics that you would like for us to discuss, or any questions like the emailers that we received today, you know, definitely write to us either on Facebook or at our blog, thementalbreakdown.com. That would be great.
Mm-hmm. Love to hear from you.
Love to hear from you. So until next time, I'm Dr. Burney.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And have a great week, and go USA again.
Stay cool and use your sunscreen.
Oh, yeah, it's so hot out there.
Dog days of summer. Are these the dog days of summer?
I don't know.
Mid-July, so it's hot.
It's hot.
No matter where you live.
No matter where you live.
Okay, stay cool.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Burney and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.